The mayor is scared and thinks the town could blow up after the execution.
Who's available?
The unit in Tyler is getting ready and can be deployed within an hour. 600 guardsmen. That should be enough.
Do it and issue a press release.
Barry darted from the office. Wayne took another sip and with hesitation said, Gil, should we at least have the conversation about a 30-day stay? Let things cool off a bit?
Hell no. We can't back down just because the blacks are upset. If we show weakness now, then they'll get louder next time. If we wait 30 days, then they'll just start this crap again. I'm not blinking. You know me better than that.
Okay, just wanted to mention it.
Don't mention it again.
You got it. Here he is, the governor said and took a step closer to the television. The crowd roared as the Reverend Jeremiah Mays took the podium. Mays was currently the loudest black radical roaming the country and was quite adept at somehow wedging himself into every conflict or episode where race was an issue. He raised his hands, called for quiet, and launched into a flowery prayer in which he beseeched the Almighty to look down upon the poor, misguided souls running the state of Texas, to open their eyes, to grant them wisdom, to touch their hearts so that this grave injustice could be stopped. He asked for the hand of God, for a miracle, for the rescue of their brother Dante Drum. When Barry returned, he refilled the shot glasses, his hands visibly shaking. The governor said, "Enough of this nonsense." He hit the mute button. "Gentlemen," he said, "I want to watch it one more time." They had watched it together several times, and with each viewing, all lingering doubts were erased. They walked to the other side of the office, to another television, and Barry picked up the remote. Dante Drum, December 23rd, 1998. He was facing the camera, a can of Coke and an uneaten donut on the table in front of him. No one else could be seen. He was subdued, tired, and frightened. He spoke slowly, in a monotone, his eyes never looking directly into the camera. Off camera, Detective Drew Kerber said,
"You've been read your Miranda rights, correct?"
"Yes."
"And you're giving this statement of your own free will, no threats, no promises of any kind, right?"
"That's right."
"Okay. Tell us what happened on Friday night, December 4th, 19 days ago."
Dante leaned forward on his elbows and looked as though he might pass out. He picked a spot on the table, stared at it, spoke to it.
"Well, me and Nicole have been sneaking around, having sex, having a good time."
"How long had this been going on?"
3 or 4 months. I liked her. She liked me. Things are getting serious. And she got scared because she was afraid people would find out. We started to fight some. She wanted to break it off. I didn't want to. I think I was in love with her. Then she wouldn't see me anymore, and this drove me crazy. All I could think about was her. She was so fine. I wanted her more than anything in the world. I was obsessed. I was crazy. Couldn't stand to think that somebody else might have her. So that Friday night, I went looking for her. I knew where she liked to hang out. I saw her car at the mall, over on the east side of the mall.
Excuse me, Dante, but I believe you said earlier that her car was parked on the west side of the mall.
Oh, that's right. The west side. So I waited and waited.
And you were driving a green Ford van, owned by your parents?
That's right. And I guess it was around 10 o'clock Friday night, and
Kerber said, "Excuse me, Dante, but you said earlier that it was closer to 11.
That's right, 11.
Go ahead. You were in the green van looking for Nicole, and you saw her car.
That's right. I was really wanting to see her, and so we were driving around looking for her car, and...
Excuse me, Dante, but you said we were driving around. You said earlier,
Yeah, me and Tory Pickett were...
But you said earlier that you were alone, that you had dropped Tory off at his mother's house.
That's right, sorry about that. At his mother's house, right. And so I was by myself at the mall, and I saw her car, and I parked and waited. When she came out, she was alone. We talked for a minute, and she agreed to get in the van. We used the van a few times on dates when we were sneaking around. And so I drove and we talked. We both got upset. She was determined to break up and I was determined to stay together. We talked about running away together to get out of Texas. Go to California where nobody would bother us, you know. But she wouldn't listen to me. She started crying, and that made me start crying. We parked behind Shiloh Church out on Travis Road, one of our places, and I said I wanted to have sex one last time. At first, she seemed okay with it, and we started making out. Then she pulled away, said stop it, said no, said she wanted to get back because her friends would be looking for her. But I couldn't stop. She started pushing me away, and I got mad, real mad. Just all of a sudden, I hated her because she was pushing me away, because I couldn't have her. If I was white, then I could have her, but because I'm not, then I'm not good enough, you know? We started fighting, and at some point she realized that I was not going to stop. She didn't resist, but she didn't give in either. When it was over, she got mad, real mad. She slapped me and said I'd raped her. And then something just happened. I snapped or something. I don't know, but I just went crazy. She was still under me, and I hit her, and I hit her again, and I couldn't believe I was hitting that beautiful face, but if I couldn't have her, then nobody else could either. I just went into a rage like some kind of wild man, and before I realized what I was doing, my hands were around her neck. I just shook her and shook her, and then she was still. Everything was very still. When I came to my senses, I just looked at her. And at some point I realized she wasn't breathing. Dante took the first sip and only sip from the Coke can. I started driving around. I had no idea where to go. I kept waiting for her to wake up, but she didn't. I called back there, but she wouldn't answer. I guess I panicked. I didn't know what time it was. I drove north, and when I realized the sun was coming up, I panicked again. I saw a sign for the Red River. I was on Route 344, and... Excuse me, Dante, but you said earlier it was Route 244. That's right, 244. I drove onto the bridge. It was still dark, no other car lights anywhere, not a sound. And I got her out of the back of the van and tossed her into the river. When I heard her splash, it made me sick. I remember crying all the way back home.
The governor stepped forward and punched the off button.
Boys, that's all I need to see. Let's go.
All three straightened their ties, buttoned their cuffs, put on their jackets, and walked out of the office. In the hallway, they were met with a security detail, one beefed up for the occasion. They took the stairs down to the street level and walked quickly to the Capitol. They waited, unseen by the crowd, until the Reverend Jeremiah Mays finished his incendiary remarks. The crowd roared when he signed off, vowing revenge. When their governor suddenly appeared at the podium, the mood changed remarkably. For a moment, those present were confused, but when they heard the words, "I'm Gil Newton, governor of the great state of Texas," they drowned him out in an avalanche of boos. He yelled back, "Thank you for coming here and expressing your First Amendment right to assemble. God bless America." Even louder boos. "Our country is great because we love democracy, the greatest system in the world." Loud boos for democracy. "You've assembled here today because you believe Dante Drum is innocent. Well, I'm here to tell you he is not. He was convicted in a fair trial. He had a good lawyer. He confessed to the crime." The boos and whistles and angry shouts were now continuous, and Newton was forced to yell into the microphone. "His case has been reviewed by dozens of judges sitting on five different courts, state and federal, and every ruling against him has been unanimous." When the roar became too loud to continue, Newton stood and smirked at the crowd, a man with power facing those with none. He nodded, acknowledging their hatred of him. When the noise subsided slightly, he leaned closer to the microphone and, with as much drama as he could muster, and knowing full well that what he was about to say would play on every evening and late newscast in Texas, said, "I refuse to grant a reprieve to Dante Drum. He is a monster. He is a guilty man." The crowd roared again and pressed forward. The governor waved and saluted for the cameras and stepped away. He was swarmed by his security team and whisked away to safety. Barry and Wayne followed, neither able to suppress a smile. Their man had just pulled off another beautiful stunt, one that would no doubt win every election from then on. Chapter 24. The last meal. The last walk. The last statement. Dante had never understood the significance of these final details. Why the fascination with what a man consumed just before he died? It wasn't as though the food gave comfort, or strengthened the body, or postponed the inevitable. The food, along with the organs, would soon be flushed out and incinerated. What good did it do? After feeding a man gruel for decades, why pamper him with something he might enjoy just before you kill him? He could vaguely recall the early days on death row and his horror of what he was supposed to eat. He'd been raised by a woman who appreciated and enjoyed the kitchen, and though Roberta relied too heavily on grease and flour, she also grew her own vegetables and was careful with processed ingredients. She loved to use herbs, spices, and peppers, and her chickens and meats were highly seasoned. The first meat Dante was served on death row was allegedly a slice of pork, and completely devoid of taste. He lost his appetite the first week, and never regained it. Now, at the end, he was expected to order a feast, and be thankful for this one last favor. As silly as it was, virtually all condemned men gave thought to the final meal. They had so little else to think about. Dante had decided days earlier that he wanted to be served nothing that even remotely resembled dishes his mother once prepared. So he ordered a pepperoni pizza and a glass of root beer. It arrived at 4 p.m., rolled into the holding cell on a small tray by two guards. Dante said nothing as they left. He'd been napping off and on throughout the afternoon, waiting on his pizza, waiting on his lawyer, waiting on a miracle. Though by 4 p.m., he'd given up. In the hallway just beyond the bars, his audience watched without a word. A guard, a prison official, and the chaplain who'd tried twice to talk to him. Twice Dante had rejected the offers of spiritual counseling. He wasn't sure why they watched him so closely, but presumed it was to prevent a suicide. How he might go about killing himself wasn't clear, not in this holding cell. If Dante could have committed suicide, he would have done so months earlier. And now, he wished he had. He would already be gone, and his mother could not watch him die. for a palate neutralized by tasteless white bread, bland applesauce, and an endless stream of mystery meats, the pizza was surprisingly delicious. He ate it slowly. Ben Jeter stepped to the bars and asked,
"How's the pizza, Dante?"
Dante did not look at the warden.
"It's fine," he said softly.
"Need anything?"
He shook his head no.
"I need a lot of things, pal, not a damned one of which you can provide. And if you could, you wouldn't. Just leave me alone."
"I think your lawyer's on the way."
Dante nodded and picked up another slice. At 4:21, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans denied relief under Dante's claim of mental illness. The Flack Law Firm immediately filed in the U.S. Supreme Court a petition for a writ of certiorari, or cert, as it's known, a request that the court hear the appeal and consider the merits of the petition. If cert was granted, the execution would be stopped, and time would pass while the dust settled and briefs were filed. If cert was denied, the claim would be dead, and so would the claimant, in all likelihood. There was no other place to appeal. At the Supreme Court building in Washington, the death clerk received the cert petition electronically and distributed it to the offices of the 9 justices. There was no word on the Boyette petition pending before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. When the King Air landed in Huntsville, Robbie called the office and was informed of the adverse ruling in the Fifth Circuit. Joey Gamble had not yet found his way to the law office of Agnes Tanner in Houston. The governor had denied a reprieve in spectacular fashion. There were currently no new fires in Sloan, but the National Guard was on the way. A depressing phone call. But then Robbie had expected little else. He, Aaron, Martha, and Keith jumped into a minivan driven by an investigator Robbie had used before, and they raced off. The prison was 15 minutes away. Keith called Dana and tried to explain what was happening in his life, but the explanation got complicated, and others were listening. She was beyond bewildered and certain that he was doing something stupid. He promised to call back in a few moments. Aaron called the office and talked to Fred Pryor. Boyette was up and moving about, but slowly. He was complaining because he had not talked to any reporters. He expected to tell his side of the story to everyone, and it seemed as if no one wanted to hear him. Robbie was frantically trying to reach Joey Gamble with no luck. Martha Handler took her usual pages of notes. At 4:30, Chief Justice Milton Prudlow convened the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals by teleconference to consider the Boyette petition in the case of Dante Drum. The court had not been impressed with Boyette. The general feeling was that he was a publicity seeker with serious credibility issues. After a brief discussion, he called the roll. The vote was unanimous. Not a single judge voted to grant relief to Dante Drum. The clerk of the court emailed the decision to the Attorney General's office, the lawyers fighting Dante's appeals, to Wayne Walcott, the governor's lawyer, and to the law office of Robbie Flack. The van was almost at the prison when Robbie got the call from Carlos. Though he'd been reminding himself throughout the afternoon that relief was unlikely, he still took it hard. "Sons of bitches," he snapped. "Didn't believe Boyette. Denied, 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 all 9 of them. Sons of bitches." "What happens next?" Keith asked.
"We run to the Supreme Court, let them see Boyette. Pray for a miracle. We're running out of options."
"Did they give a reason?" Martha asked.
"Nope, they don't have to. The problem is that we want desperately to believe Boyette, and they, the Chosen 9, have no interest in believing him. Believing Boyette would upset the system."
"Excuse me, I gotta call Agnes Tanner. Gamble's probably in a strip club getting plastered while a lap dancer works him over." There were no strippers, no stops or detours, just a couple of wrong turns. Joey walked into the law office of Agnes Tanner at 4:40, and she was waiting at the door. Miss Tanner was a hard-nosed divorce lawyer who, when bored, occasionally volunteered for a capital murder defense. She knew Robbie well, though they had not spoken in over a year. She was holding the affidavit and after a tense, nice to meet you, led Joey to a small meeting room. She wanted to ask him where he had been, why it took so long, whether he was drunk, if he realized they were out of time, and why he lied 9 years ago and had sat on his fat ass ever since. She wanted to grill him for an hour, but there was no time. Plus, he was moody and unpredictable, according to Robbie. "You can read this, or I'll tell you what it says," she said, waving the affidavit. Joey sat in a chair, buried his face in his hands, and said,
"Just tell me."
"It gives your name, address, all that crap. It says you testified at the trial of Dante Drum on such and such date in October 1999, that you gave crucial testimony on behalf of the prosecution, and in your testimony you told the jury that on the night of Nicole's disappearance, at about the same time, you saw a green Ford van driving suspiciously through the parking lot where her car was parked, and that the driver appeared to be a black male, and that the van was very similar to the one owned by Dante Drum. There are a lot more details, but we don't have time for details. Are you with me, Joey?"
"Yes."
His eyes were covered and he appeared to be crying. "You now recant that testimony and swear that it was not true. You're saying that you lied at trial. Got that, Joey?"
He nodded his head in the affirmative.
"And it goes on to say that you made the anonymous phone call to Detective Drew Kerber in which you informed him that Dante Drum was the killer. Again, lots of details, but I'll spare you. I think you understand all this, Joey, don't you?"
He uncovered his face, wiped tears, and said, "I've lived with this for a long time."
"Then fix it, Joey." She slapped the affidavit on the table and thrust a pen at him. "Page 5, bottom right, quickly." He signed the affidavit, and after it was notarized, it was scanned and emailed to the Defender Group office in Austin. Agnes Tanner waited for a confirmation, but it bounced back. She called a lawyer at the Defender Group. It had not been received. There had been some problems with their internet server. Agnes sent it again, and again, it was not received. She barked at a clerk who began faxing the 5 pages. Joey, suddenly neglected, left the office without being noticed. He at least expected someone to say thanks. The prison in Huntsville is called the Walls Unit. It's the oldest prison in Texas, built the old way with tall, thick brick walls, thus the name. Its storied history includes the incarceration of once famous outlaws and gunslingers. Its death chamber has been used to execute more men and women than any other state. The Walls Unit is proud of its history. A block of the oldest cells has been preserved and presents a step back in time. Tours can be arranged. Robbie had been there twice before, always hurried and burdened and disinterested in the history of the Walls Unit. When he and Keith walked in the front door, they were met by Ben Jeter, who managed to smile.
"Hello, Mr. Flack," he said.
"Hello, Warden," Robbie said grimly, grabbing his wallet. "This is Dante's spiritual advisor, the Reverend Keith Schroeder." The warden shook hands cautiously.
"Wasn't aware that Drum had a spiritual advisor."
"Well, he does now."
"Okay, give me some ID.
They handed Jeter their driver's licenses, and he gave them to a guard behind a counter.
"Follow me," he said.
Jeter had been the warden at Walls Unit for 11 years, and every execution belonged to him. It was a duty he assumed, but didn't ask for. It was just part of the job. He was noted for his detachment and professionalism. All movements were precise, all details followed without variation. Texas was so efficient in its death work that other states sent over prison officials for consultation. Ben Jeter could show them precisely how it should be done. He had asked 298 men and 3 women if they had any last words. 15 minutes later, he declared them all dead.
"What about the appeals?"
he asked, one step ahead of Robbie, 2 ahead of Keith, who was still in a daze. They were zipping down a hallway, its walls lined with fading black and whites of former wardens and dead governors.
"Doesn't look good," Robbie said. "Couple of balls in the air, but nothing much."
"So you think we'll go at 6?
"I don't know,"
Robbie said, unwilling to offer much.
Go at 6, Keith said to himself, as if they were catching a flight or waiting for a kickoff.
They stopped at a door and Jeter waved a card. It opened and they stepped outside, walked 20 feet, then entered the death house. Keith's heart was pounding, and he was so dizzy he needed to sit down. Inside he saw bars, rows of bars, in a dimly lit block of cells. There were guards in the way, 2 men in bad suits, the warden, all looking at the holding cell.
"Dante, your lawyer is here," Jeter announced, as if he were delivering a gift.
Dante rose to his feet and smiled. Metal clanged, the door slid open, and Dante took a step. Robbie grabbed him, clutched him, whispered something in his ear. Dante squeezed his lawyer, the first real human contact in almost a decade. Both were crying when they separated. Next to the holding cell was the visiting cell, a space identical except for a wall of glass behind the bars that allowed privacy as the lawyer met with his client for the last time. The rules allowed 1 hour of visitation. Most condemned men saved a few minutes for the last prayer with the prison chaplain. The rules stated that the hour of visitation ran from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m., leaving the inmate all alone at the end. Warden Jeter, though a stickler for the rules, knew when to bend them. He also knew that Dante Drum had been a model prisoner, unlike many, and that meant a lot in his business. Jeter tapped his watch and said,
"It's 4:45, Mr. Flack. You have 60 minutes.
"Thank you."
Dante entered the visiting cell and sat on the edge of the bed. Robbie followed him and sat on a stool. A guard closed the glass door, then rolled the bars in place. They were alone, knees touching. Robbie put a hand on Dante's shoulder and worked to keep his composure. He'd agonized over whether he should bring up Boyette. On the one hand, Dante had probably accepted the inevitable and, with an hour to go, was ready for whatever stood beyond. He certainly seemed to be at peace. Why upset him with a wild new story? On the other hand, Dante might appreciate knowing that the truth would finally be known. His name would be cleared, even though posthumously. The truth, though, was far from certain, and Robbie decided not to mention Boyette.
"Thanks for coming, Robbie," Dante said in a whisper.
"I promised I'd be here until the end. I'm sorry I couldn't stop this, Dante. I'm truly sorry."
"Come on, Robbie. You did the best you could. You're still fighting, aren't you?"
"Oh, yes. We have some last-minute appeals still out there, so there's a chance."
"How much of a chance, Robbie?"
"Chance. Joey Gamble has admitted he lied at trial. He got drunk last night in a strip club and admitted everything. We secretly recorded it and filed a petition this morning. Court turned us down. Then around 3:30 this afternoon, Joey contacted us and said he wants to admit everything."
Dante's only reaction was to slowly shake his head in disbelief. "We're trying to file another petition, one that includes his sworn affidavit, and it gives us a chance." They were hunched over, their heads almost touching, speaking in whispers. There was so much to say, and so little. Robbie was bitter at the system, angry to the point of violence, burdened by his lack of success in defending Dante. But most of all, he was, at the moment, just sad. For Dante, the brief stay in the holding cell was confusing. Ahead, not 30 feet away, was a door that led to death, a door he preferred not to open. Behind him was death row and the maddening existence of isolation in a cell he preferred to never see again. He thought he was ready for the door, but he was not, nor did he wish to ever see Polensky again.
"Don't beat yourself up, Robbie. I'll be all right."
Keith, with permission, stepped outside and tried to breathe. It had snowed Monday morning in Topeka. Now it felt like 80 degrees in Texas. He leaned against a fence and stared at the razor wire above him. He called Dana and told her where he was, what he was doing, what he was thinking. She seemed as astonished as he was. With the drum matter out of the way, Chief Justice Milton Prudlow left his office and hurried to the Rolling Creek Country Club in West Central Austin. He had a 5 p.m. tennis match with a major contributor to his last and next campaigns. In traffic, his cell phone rang. The clerk of the court informed him that they had received a call from the Defender Group and that another petition was in the works.
"What time do you have?" Prudlow demanded.
4:49.
"I get so tired of this crap," Prudlow said. "We close at 5, and everybody knows it."
"Yes, sir," the clerk said. The clerk knew quite well that Justice Prudlow despised the last-minute Hail Marys thrown by desperate defense lawyers. The cases drag on for years and with little activity. Then, with hours to go, the lawyers suddenly shift into high gear.
"Any idea what they're filing?" Prudlow asked.
"I think it's the same thing they filed this morning, an eyewitness is recanting. They're having trouble with their computers."
"Gee, that's original. We close at 5, and at 5 I want the door locked, and not a minute after, understand?"
"Yes, sir." At 4:45, Cicely Avis and two paralegals left the Defender Group offices with the petition and Gamble's affidavit. All 12 copies. As they sped through traffic, Cicely called the clerk's office with the heads up that they were on the way. The clerk informed her that the office would close at 5, the usual time, 5 days a week.
"But we have a petition that includes a sworn affidavit from the only eyewitness at trial," she insisted.
"I think we've already seen that one," the clerk said.
"You have not. This has a sworn statement."
"I just talked to the Chief Justice.
We close at 5.
"But we'll be a few minutes late."
"We close at 5.
Travis Boyette was sitting by a window in the conference room, cane across his knees, watching the chaos of frantic people yelling at each other. Fred Pryor was close by, also watching. Unable to make sense of what was happening, Boyette stood and approached the table.
"Can anybody tell me what's going on?" he asked.
"Yep, we're losing," Carlos snapped at him.
"What about my statement? Is anybody listening to me?"
"The answer's no. The court was not impressed."
"They think I'm lying?"
"Yes, Travis, they think you're lying. I'm sorry, we believe you, but we don't have a vote."
"I want to talk to the reporters."
"I think they're busy chasing fires."
Sammy Thomas looked at her laptop, scribbled down something, and handed it to Boyette. "This is the cell phone number of one of our local TV idiots." She pointed to a table near the television. "That is a telephone. Feel free to do whatever you want, Mr. Boyette." Travis shuffled over to the phone, punched the numbers, and waited. He was being watched by Sammy, Carlos, Bonnie, and Fred Pryor. He held the receiver and stared at the floor. Then he flinched and said,
Yes. Is this Garrett?"
"Okay, look. My name is Travis Boyette, and I'm down at the law office of Robbie Flack. I was involved in the murder of Nicole Yarber, and I'd like to go on the air and make a confession."
Pause. The tick.
"I want to confess to the murder of the girl. Dante Drum had nothing to do with it."
Pause. The tick.
"Yes, I want to say that on the air, and I have a lot more to say as well."
The others could almost hear the frantic thrill in Garrett's voice. "What a story." Boyette said,
"Okay," and hung up.
He looked around the conference room and said,
"They'll be here in 10 minutes.
Sammy said, "Fred, why don't you take him out front somewhere near the landing and find a good spot?" Boyette said,
"I can leave if I want to, right? I don't have to stay here."
"You're a free man as far as I'm concerned," Sammy said. "Do whatever you want. I really don't care." Boyette and Pryor left the conference room and waited outside the train station. Carlos took the call from Cicely Avis. She explained that they arrived at the court at 5:07. The doors were locked,
The offices closed. She called the clerk's cell phone. The clerk said he was not there. He was, in fact, driving home. Dante's final petition would not be filed. According to club records, Chief Justice Milton Prudlow and his guest played tennis on Court 8 for an hour, beginning at 5 p.m. Chapter 25. Paul Coffey's cabin was on a small lake 10 miles south of Sloan. He'd owned it for years and used it as an escape, a hiding place, a fishing hole. He'd also used it as a love nest during his romp with Judge Vivian Grail, an unfortunate episode that led to an ugly divorce that almost led to the loss of the cabin. His ex-wife got their home instead. After lunch on Thursday, he left his office and drove to the cabin. The town was in a meltdown. It was beginning to feel dangerous. The phone was ringing nonstop, and no one in his office was even attempting to appear productive. He escaped the frenzy and was soon in the peaceful countryside, where he prepared for a party he'd thrown together a week earlier. He iced down the beer, stocked the bar, puttered around the cabin, and waited for his guests. They began arriving before 5 p.m. Most had left work early, and everyone needed a drink. They gathered on a deck near the edge of the water. Retired lawyers, active lawyers, two assistant prosecutors in Coffey's office, an investigator, and other assorted friends, almost all of whom had some connection to the law. Drew Kerber and another detective were there. Everyone wanted to talk to Kerber, the cop who broke the case. Without his skillful interrogation of Dante Drum, there would have been no conviction. He'd found the bloodhounds that picked up Nicole's scent on the green Ford van. He'd deftly manipulated a jailhouse snitch into obtaining yet another confession from their suspect. Good, solid police work. The Drum case was Kerber's crowning moment, and he intended to savor its final moments. Not to be outdone, Paul Coffey commanded his share of attention. He would retire in a few years, and in his old age he would have something to brag about. Against a ferocious defense mounted by Robbie Flack and his team, Coffey and his boys had fought on, fought for justice, fought for Nicole. The fact that he had gotten his prize death verdict without a body was even more reason to gloat. The boos loosened the tension. They howled with laughter at the story of their beloved governor shouting down a black mob and calling Drum a monster. Things were a bit quieter when Coffey described the petition filed hardly 2 hours ago in which some nut claimed to be the killer. But have no fear, he assured them. The Court of Appeals had already denied relief. Only one other appeal was in play, a bogus one. Hell, they're all bogus. But it was as good as dead in the Supreme Court. Coffey happily assured his guests that justice was on the verge of prevailing. They swapped stories about the church burnings, the cotton gin fire, the growing mob in Civitan Park, and the coming of the cavalry. The National Guard was expected by 6 p.m., and there was no shortage of opinions about whether it was actually needed. Coffey was barbecuing chicken on a grill, breasts and thighs coated with a thick sauce. But the treat of the night, he announced, would be drumsticks. A chorus of laughter echoed across the lake. Huntsville is also the home of Sam Houston State University. The school has an enrollment of 16,000, 81% white, 12% black, 6% Hispanic, and 1% other. Late Thursday afternoon, many of the black students were drifting toward the prison, some 8 blocks away in central Huntsville. Operation Detour may have failed in its attempt to block roads, but it would not fail in its efforts to raise a little hell. The streets closer to the prison were sealed off by Texas State Troopers and Huntsville Police. The authorities were expecting trouble, and security around Wall's unit was tight. The black students gathered 3 blocks from the prison and began making noise. When Robbie stepped out of the death house to work the phone, he heard it in the distance, the organized chanting of 1,000 voices. Dante! Dante! He could see nothing but the exterior walls of the death house and chain-link fencing. but he could tell the crowd was close. What difference did it make? It was too late for protests and marches. He listened for a second, then called the office. Sammy Thomas answered by blurting, "They wouldn't let us file the gamble petition. They locked the doors at 5 p.m. Robbie, we got there 7 minutes late. They knew we were coming, too." His first impulse was to launch the phone against the nearest brick wall and watch it shatter into 1,000 pieces. But he was too stunned to move. She went on. "The Defender Group called the clerk a few minutes before 5. They were actually in a car racing to file. Clerk said, 'Too bad,' said he'd talked to Prudlow and the office closed at 5. Are you there, Robbie?"
"Yes, go on."
"Nothing left but the cert petitions before the Supremes. No word yet." Robbie was leaning on a chain-link fence, trying to steady himself. A tantrum would not help matters now. He could throw things and curse and maybe file lawsuits tomorrow, but he needed to think. "I don't expect any help from the Supreme Court, do you?" he asked. "No, not really."
"Well then, it's almost over."
"Yes, Robbie. That's the feeling around here."
"You know, Sammy, all we needed was 24 hours. If Travis Boyette and Joey Gamble had given us 24 hours, we could have stopped this damn thing, and there's a very good chance Dante would one day walk out of here."
24 hours.
"Agreed.
And speaking of Boyette, he's outside waiting for a TV crew. He called them, not us. Though I did give him the number. He wants to talk."
"Let him talk, damn it. As of now, let him tell the world. I don't care."
"Is Carlos ready with the video blast?"
"I think so."
"Then turn him loose. I want every big newspaper and television station in the state to get the video right now. Let's make as much noise as possible. If we're going down, then let's go down in flames."
"You got it, boss."
Robbie listened to the distant chants for a moment while staring at his phone. Who could he call? Was there anyone in the world who could help? Keith flinched when the metal bars closed behind him. This was not his first prison visit, but it was the first time he'd been locked in a cell. His breathing was labored and his colon was in knots, but he had prayed for strength. It was a very short prayer. "God, please give me courage and wisdom. Then please get me out of here." Dante did not rise when Keith entered the visitor's cell, but he did smile and offer a hand. Keith shook it, a soft, passive handshake. "I'm Keith Schroeder," he said as he sat on the stool, his back to the wall, his shoes inches from Dante's.
"Robbie said you were a good guy," Dante said.
He seemed to concentrate on Keith's collar, as if to confirm that he was in fact a minister. Keith's voice froze as he thought about what to say. A grave, "How are you doing?" seemed ludicrous. What do you say to a young man who will die in less than an hour, whose death is certain and could be avoided? "You talk about death."
"Robbie tells me you didn't want to talk to the prison chaplain," Keith said. "He works for the system. The system has persecuted me for 9 years, and it'll soon get what it wants. So I concede nothing to the system."
Makes perfect sense, Keith thought. Dante was sitting straighter, his arms folded across his chest, as though he would welcome a good debate about religion, faith, God, heaven, hell, or anything else Keith wanted to discuss.
"You're not from Texas, are you?" Dante asked.
"Kansas."
The accent. "Do you believe the state has a right to kill people?"
"No."
"Do you think Jesus would approve of the killing of inmates for retribution?"
"Of course not."
"Does thou shalt not kill apply to everybody, or did Moses forget the exemption for state governments?"
"The government is owned by the people. The commandment applies to everyone." Dante smiled and relaxed a little.
"Okay, you pass. We can talk. What's on your mind?"
Keith breathed a little easier, pleased to have survived the entrance exam. He half expected to meet a young man without all of his mental assets,
and he was wrong. Robbie's noisy claim that Dante had been driven insane by death row seemed misguided. Keith plunged ahead. Robbie tells me you were raised in a church, baptized at an early age, had a strong faith, raised by parents who were devout Christians. All true. I was close to God, Mr. Schroeder, until God abandoned me. Please, call me Keith. I read a story about a man who once sat right here, in this cell. His name was Daryl Clark, young man from West Texas, Midland, I think. He'd killed some people in a drug war, got convicted and sent to death row at the old unit at Ellis. While he was on death row, someone gave him a Bible, and someone else shared a Christian testimony. Clark became a Christian and grew very close to the Lord. His appeals ran out, and his execution date was set. He embraced the end. He looked forward to death because he knew the exact moment when he would enter the kingdom of heaven. I can't think of another story quite like Daryl Clark's. What's your point? My point is, you're about to die, and you know when it will happen. Very few people know this. Soldiers in battle may feel like dead men, but there's always a chance they'll survive. I suppose some victims of horrible crimes know they're at the end, but they have such short notice. You, though, have had this date for months. Now the hour is at hand, and it's not a bad time to make amends with God. I know the legend of Daryl Clark. His final words were, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." Luke 23, verse 46, the last words of Jesus, before he died on the cross, according to Luke, anyway. But you're missing something here, Keith. Clark killed three people, execution style, and after they convicted him, he never made a serious claim of innocence. He was guilty. I am not. Clark deserved to be punished, not to be killed, but in prison for life. Me? I am innocent. True. But death is death. And in the end, nothing else matters except your relationship with God. So you're trying to convince me that I should go running back to God here at the last minute and just sort of forget the past 9 years. You blame God for the past 9 years? Yes, I do. This is what happened to me, Keith. I was 18 years old, a long-time Christian, still active in the church, but also doing some things that most kids do. Nothing bad, but hell, when you grow up in a house as strict as mine, you're gonna rebel a little. I was a good student. The football thing was on hold, but I wasn't running drugs and beating people. I stayed off the streets. I was looking forward to college. And for some reason, I guess I never understand, a bolt of lightning hits me square in the forehead. I'm wearing handcuffs. I'm in jail. My picture's on the front page. I'm declared guilty long before the trial. My fate is determined by 12 white people, half of them good, solid Baptists. The prosecutor was a Methodist. The judge was Presbyterian, or at least their names were on church rolls somewhere. They were also screwing each other, but I guess we all have a weakness for flesh. Most of us, anyway. Screwing each other, yet pretending to give me a fair trial. The jury was a bunch of rednecks. I remember sitting in the courtroom looking at their faces as they condemned me to death. Hard, unforgiving Christian faces, and thinking to myself, we don't worship the same God. And we don't. How can God allow his people to kill so often? Answer that, please. God's people are often wrong, Dante. But God is never wrong. You can't blame him. The fight left him. The weight of the moment returned. Dante leaned forward with his elbows on his knees and hung his head. I was a faithful servant, Keith. And look what I get. Robbie walked in from the outside and stood by the visitor's cell. Keith's time was up. Would you pray with me, Dante? Why, I prayed the first 3 years I was in prison and things just got worse. Could have prayed 10 times a day and I'd still be sitting right here talking to you. All right. Mind if I pray? Go right ahead. Keith closed his eyes. He found it hard to pray under the circumstances. Dante staring at him. Robbie anxiously waiting, the clock ticking louder and louder. He asked God to give Dante strength and courage, and have mercy on his soul. Amen. When he finished, he stood and patted Dante on the shoulder, still not believing that he would be dead in less than an hour. Dante said, "Thanks for coming." "I'm honored to meet you, Dante." They shook hands again. Then the metal clanged and the doors opened. Keith stepped out. Robbie stepped in. The clock on the wall, indeed the only clock that mattered, gave the time as 5:34. The looming execution of a man claiming innocence did nothing to arouse the national media. The stories had become so commonplace. However, the tit-for-tat angle of the church burnings on the eve of the execution woke up a few producers. The melee at the high school added some fuel, but the possibility of a race riot, now that was too good to be ignored. Toss in the drama of the National Guard, and by late afternoon, Sloan was buzzing with brightly painted television vans from Dallas and Houston and other cities, most providing direct feeds to network and cable stations. When word spread that a man claiming to be the real killer wanted to confess on camera, the train station became an instant magnet for the media. With Fred Pryor directing things, or at least attempting to keep some order, Travis Boyette stood on the bottom step of the platform and looked at the reporters and the cameras. Microphones were thrust at him like bayonets. Fred stood at his right side, actually shoving some of the reporters back. "Quiet!" Fred barked at them. Then he nodded at Travis and said, "Go ahead." Travis was as stiff as a deer in headlights, but he swallowed hard and plunged in. "My name is Travis Boyette, and I killed Nicole Yarber. Dante Drum had nothing to do with her murder. I acted alone. I abducted her, raped her repeatedly, then strangled her to death. I disposed of her body. And it's not in the Red River." "Where is it?" "It's in Missouri where I left it." "Why'd you do it?" "Because I can't stop myself. I've raped other women, lots of them. Sometimes I got caught, sometimes I didn't." This startled the reporters, and a few seconds elapsed before the next question. "So are you a convicted rapist?" "Oh, yes. I have 4 or 5 convictions." "Are you from Sloan?" "No, but I was living here when I killed Nicole." "Did you know her?" Dana Schroeder had been parked in front of the television in the den for the past 2 hours, glued to CNN, waiting for more news from Sloan. There had been 2 reports, brief little snippets about the unrest in the National Guard. She had watched the governor make a fool of himself. The story, though, was gathering momentum. When she saw the face of Travis Boyette, she said out loud, "There he is." Her husband was at death row consoling the man convicted of the killing, and she was watching the one who had actually committed the crime. Joey Gamble was in a bar, the first one he'd seen when he left the office of Agnes Tanner. He was drunk, but still aware of what was happening. There were 2 televisions hanging from the ceiling at opposite ends of the bar. One was on SportsCenter, the other on CNN. When Joey saw the story from Sloan, he walked closer to the television. He listened to Boyette as he talked about killing Nicole. "You son of a bitch," Joey mumbled. And the bartender gave him a quizzical look. But then he felt good about himself. He'd finally told the truth, and now the real killer had come forward. Dante would be spared. He ordered another beer. Judge Elias Henry was sitting with his wife in the den of their home, not far from Civitan Park. The doors were locked. His hunting rifles were loaded and ready. A police car drove by every 10 minutes. A helicopter watched from above. The air was thick with the smell of smoke. Smoke from the fireworks party at the park, and smoke from the destroyed buildings. The mob could be heard,
Its non-stop drumming and booming rap and screeching chants had only intensified throughout the afternoon. Judge and Mrs. Henry had discussed leaving for the night. They had a son in Tyler, an hour away, and he had encouraged them to flee, if only for a few hours. But they decided to stay, primarily because the neighbors were staying and there was strength in numbers. The judge had chatted with the chief of police, who somewhat nervously assured him that things were under control. The television was on, another breaking story from Sloan. The judge grabbed the remote and turned up the volume. Then there was the man he'd seen in the video not 3 hours earlier. Travis Boyette was talking, giving details, staring at a bunch of microphones. "Did you know the girl?" a reporter asked. "I'd never met her, but I had followed her. I knew who she was, knew she was a cheerleader. I picked her out."
"How did you abduct her?"
"I found her car, parked next to it, waited until she came out of the mall. I used a gun, she didn't argue. I've done this before."
"Have you been convicted in Texas before?"
"No. Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas. You can check the records. I'm telling the truth here, and the truth is that I did the crime, not Dante Drum."
"Why are you coming forward now and not a year ago?"
"I should have, but I figured the courts down here would finally realize they had the wrong guy. I just got out of prison in Kansas, and a few days ago I saw in the paper where they were getting ready to execute Drum. Surprised me. So here I am."
"Right now, only the governor can stop the execution. What would you say to him?"
"I'd say you're about to kill an innocent man. You give me 24 hours, and I'll show you the body of Nicole Yarber. Just 24 hours, Mr. Governor."
Judge Henry scratched his chin with his knuckles and said,
"Bad night just got worse."
Barry and Wayne were in the governor's office watching Boyette on CNN. Their governor was down the hall being interviewed for the fifth or sixth time since his courageous handling of the angry mob.
"We'd better go get him," Wayne said.
"Yep, I'll go. You keep an eye on this."
5 minutes later, the governor was watching a rerun of Boyette.
"He's obviously a crackpot," Newton said after a few seconds. "Where's the bourbon?"
3 glasses were filled, and the bourbon was sipped as they listened to Boyette talk about the body.
"How did you kill Nicole?"
"Strangled her with her belt, black leather with a round silver buckle, still around her neck."
Boyette reached under his shirt and pulled out a ring. He thrust it at the cameras.
"This is Nicole's. I've worn it since the night I took her. Has her initials and everything."
"How did you dispose of the body?"
"Let's just say it's underground."
"How far from here?"
"I don't know, 5 or 6 hours. Again, if the governor would give us 24 hours, we can find it. That'll prove I'm right."
"Who is this guy?" the governor asked.
"A serial rapist, rap sheet a mile long."
"It's amazing how they always manage to pop up right before the execution," Newton said.
"Probably getting money from Flack."
All three managed a nervous laugh. The laughter at the lake was interrupted when a guest walked past a TV inside and saw what was happening. The party quickly moved indoors, and 30 people huddled around the small screen. No one spoke. No one seemed to breathe as Boyette went on, perfectly willing to answer any question with a blunt response.
"Y'all ever hear this guy, Paul?"
asked one of the retired lawyers. Paul shook his head no.
"He's at Flack's office, the train station.
Robbie's up to his old tricks."
Not a smile, not a grin, not a forced chuckle. When Boyette produced her ring and freely displayed it for the cameras, fear swept through the cabin, and Paul Coffey found his way to a chair. The breaking news was not heard by everyone. At the prison, Reva and her gang were gathered in a small office where they waited for the van ride to the death chamber. Not far away, the family of Dante waited too.
For the next hour, the two groups of witnesses would be in close proximity to each other, but carefully separated. At 5:40, the family of the victim was loaded in a white unmarked prison van and driven to the death house, a ride that lasted less than 10 minutes. Once there, they were led through an unmarked door into a small square room 12 feet long and 12 feet wide. There were no chairs, no benches. The walls were blank, unmarked. Before them was a closed curtain, and they had been told that on the other side of the curtain was the actual death chamber. At 5:45, the Drum family made the same trip and entered their witness room through another door. The witness rooms were side by side. A loud cough in one could be heard in the other. They waited. Chapter 26. At 5:40, the U.S. Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, refused to hear Dante's insanity petition. 10 minutes later, the court again, 5-4, denied cert on the Boyette petition. Robbie took the calls outside the holding cell. He closed his phone, walked inside to Warden Jeter, and whispered, "It's over. No more appeals." Jeter nodded grimly and said, "You got 2 minutes." "Thanks." Robbie re-entered the holding cell and broke the news to Dante. There was nothing else to do. The fight was over. Dante closed his eyes and breathed deeply as the reality set in. Until that moment, there had always been hope, however distant, however remote and unlikely. Then he swallowed hard, managed to smile, and inched closer to Robbie. Their knees were touching, their heads just inches apart. "Say, Robbie, you think they'll ever catch the dude who killed Nicole?" Again, Robbie wanted to tell him about Boyette, but that story was far from over. The truth was anything but certain. "I don't know, Dante, I can't predict." "Why?" "Here's what you gotta do, Robbie. If they never find the guy, then folks will always believe it was me. But if they find him, then you gotta promise me you'll clear my name. Will you promise me, Robbie? I don't care how long it takes, but you gotta clear my name."